Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Got our second guest of the week right now, Dave Finocchio, co-founder and CEO of Bleacher Report. I'm going to start with a real difficult question. Could you ever have foreseen when you and several of your friends launched the site that it would grow to be the level it is at now?
No. How's that for an answer? No, that was not something that we seriously ever considered.
What were your goals at the launch?
We wanted to do all the things we've ended up doing. I don't think any of us necessarily thought it would work, but I really was passionate about trying to build a sports media brand that was super resonant to like my generation. I was just finishing college when I was thinking about doing Bleacher Report. And I thought my generation was kind of stuck with our dads and grandfathers and grandmothers and whatever's kind of sports properties and their generation's perspective on sports and how they use sports in their lives. And I just kind of looking around my college campus and how my friends talk to each other about sports, and there was just nothing at the time that you would describe as super shareable or snackable or like especially culturally relevant in a way that was like, you know, took all the off-field stuff that happens in sports into account. And I just thought sports fans in our generation and younger kind of deserve better. And I thought maybe the traditional sports properties needed some healthy competition. So that was the impetus.
What was the point and how long was it after launch where something clicked and you're like, oh man, we've got something real here?
That's a funny question. It was such and still continues to be such a day-to-day grind. That's just how this goes. Every hour, every day type of thing. I think, so we had a long journey, first of all, figuring out how to build a media business, which, you know, it's like there are a lot of people who love sports and focus on the content side of sports and being a consumer of sports content. But it's really, really hard to build new media businesses for all kinds of reasons. And I think the first thing we figured out was that if we were ever going to build something that would be loved by a lot of people, or at least this is our approach, that we had to build a sustainable business, and we had to have a big enough audience to be able to attract advertisers like every single day to make this thing work. And so, you know, we ended up innovating a lot around how kind of digital publishers get audience and then retain audience. And to answer your question, one of the first breakthrough moments for me was when we figured out that just having a lot of people hit our website and then leave immediately, like if they came to an article through search or through a partnership, wasn't so great. And we needed to figure out how to get those people to come back to us, like, you know, pretty close to every day. And we launched newsletters for every major team and league in the United States and in the professional leagues in the United States. And we started curating not just the best Bleacher Report content, but the best content from around the web. And the value proposition was basically like, if you follow the Chicago Bears, we'll send you a newsletter. And mind you, this is like 2009, so it was a long time ago. We'll send you a newsletter that has anything relevant, anything entertaining about the Bears. We'll put it in one place for you. And those newsletters like took off like gangbusters. The engagement rates around them, the the amount that people share them with their friends and then signed up without us having to do anything. We had college football newsletters, I think, you know, no surprise, in the SEC, where in season, the open rates of the newsletters were over 70%, which is just crazy. I think the average open rate of a content newsletter is like 12%, something like that. So that was the first time where I really said to myself, okay, I think we have a winning product here, and we're onto something that people aren't just consuming because they need information, but they're consuming it because they actually love it, and they're actually starting to become fans of our brand, not just like some random article they clicked on through Google.
And then you mentioned the business side of things. When was the time that what was like your first big advertising partnership where you just like couldn't believe the size of the check they were writing?
That's a really good question. I actually have no idea. I remember our very first advertising partnership was for the DVD release of We Are Marshall that we did in probably like pretty close after we launched. We did a couple of sporadic advertising deals that came in here and there. And that was probably as early as 2007, but it was for not very much money at all. I think, you know, the first time we did a deal that was worth $100,000, I'm sure that was a really big deal. I remember the first time that we realized that we generated $1 million of revenue in the life cycle of our business. That at the time seemed like a really, really big deal. I remember some of the worst advertising campaigns and the best ones that we've done, but it's just kind of gotten crazy over time. If I think back to how much like a $50,000 deal would have meant to us, or a $100,000 deal would have meant to us at certain points in our company's history. And now they kind of come in. We're very fortunate they come in every single day and deals that are a lot bigger than that as well. So the whole thing's just come a really long way, mostly because we've been able to hire incredible people over the years who are super smart and work really hard. So it's been a process.
How did the acquisition from Turner come about?
So Turner first got a hold of us, if I recall correctly, in the summer of 2011. And, you know, Turner Broadcasting is one of the largest rights holders of sports in the United States. They obviously have NBA. They've got March Madness, which is going on right now. But they also have MLB playoffs and some golf and a bunch of other stuff. We'll now have Champions League rights starting in August of this coming year. So the portfolio is super significant, but they didn't have a digital extension of Turner Sports, which meant that, you know, just from a pure business standpoint, they weren't able to monetize the digital and then later the social rights that came with buying those super expensive TV packages. So just from a pure dollars and cents standpoint, like they needed somewhere to put them. And so they called us. From our standpoint, Turner kind of stood out amongst the, you know, the pack of traditional sports players because their brand sensibilities were just closer to ours. You know, inside the NBA is as much an entertainment show as it is a, you know, basketball analysis show. It's both. And we just kind of saw eye to eye about our perspective on sports as, you know, sports can be very serious, but first and foremost, sports is entertainment. And so we got along really well. And then we also felt like because of the rights issues, just the value, like the potential value of our company, like what it could sell for someday, or like there was no way our company was ever going to be big enough to go public. But we thought that we needed access to highlights and needed access to footage in order to create the type of content that we wanted to create to kind of get our brand and get our audience to the next level. So we felt like we needed to partner up with someone to do that. And so, you know, they made the money side of it work for us, where you know, we were, those of us who founded the company and were senior at the company did really well, which was awesome, and our investors did really well. And then the company ended up in a great spot where Turner has believed in our vision for what Bleacher Report could be someday, and still does, and continues to support us financially in a significant way. They've poured a lot of money into the business at a time when a lot of digital media companies are cutting back, which is awesome to be able to make kind of a contrarian play like that. And it's just been a great relationship. It's honestly gone a lot better than I think any of us ever imagined that it would. And it continues to go well.
So earlier you mentioned your need to kind of build a sticky audience, so to speak, in terms of people return to it every day or even more, as opposed to just driving by through Facebook or Google or what have you. And I think the key moment in terms of Bleacher Report's audience has to be, not moment, but the key tool in terms of it isn't necessarily the content or even the content creators, but the fact that the app is so functional. And back to what you said with Turner having all of those live rights, you not only have this functional app, but you've got it being advertised on the MLB playoffs, the NBA playoffs, golf, et cetera, et cetera. How big has that TV advertising been for the growth of the app?
I'd say it's huge for our brand. In terms of like TV tune-in driving downloads directly, it's pretty good. It's maybe not as good as some people might think, but our app has been downloaded over 20 million times, and we probably, it's impossible to know actually exactly how many people use our app and our alerts, but it's probably 7 to 8 million people on a monthly basis who give us kind of the privilege of being their narrator for all things that go on in the world of sports and culture. And those people on average use the app, like the average Bleacher user actually connects with the app more than 30 times every day. So it's a super, super engaged audience, which we always look to improve the product experience, and there are a lot of things we're working on right now to make it even better. The fact that once people start using the app, and especially once they turn alerts on, our engagement rates are crazy high, and our minutes per user numbers are pretty competitive with like social platforms, and look a lot more like an Instagram or a Snapchat than they do, a normal sports app. And I think that's just been really, really awesome for our brand that we have a product like that that people love so much that we can then use TV and use other marketing channels to try to get people into it, because we're just so confident that once they start using it the right way that they'll love it.
Now, you mentioned this earlier when you were talking about the newsletters, how you, for example, like if someone subscribed to the Bears newsletter, you wouldn't only send them to Bleacher Report. You guys also do that with the app in terms of sending outbound traffic to various websites in sports. What is this something like that you plan to continue doing for indefinitely? Or can you tell me about the strategy of why you don't only send stuff people to Bleacher Report articles? Because I know we appreciate it at the Big Lead, but I'm always wondering, like, why do they do that?
So I was really passionate about doing that. I started doing that in our newsletters when we launched them in the beginning of 2009. And then we kind of, when apps got really big on iOS, we launched an app because it was basically just a way better version of our newsletter products, where you could follow all your teams in the same place. And then the app allowed information to come real time, because the sports world is like a real time soap opera versus waiting for a newsletter to come on like a random Tuesday. So the thing with curating other people's content and sending them traffic is, I'm surprised that more sites don't do it. We are used more for a lot of users, more of like a portal, the same way that Google is or Facebook is. So you could kind of make an argument more and more that our app is kind of a hybrid between a content app and really a platform. And for us, it's all about building trust with our users that they will come to us over and over and over again because they trust that our, what we call programmers, the people who put the content in the app and who write the headlines and who direct them to articles are vetting it for them in advance. And so they know that if we're putting it in front of them, it's worth their while. So we're providing them with that service. And yeah, we're, for I think most sports sites in the United States, we're somewhere between their, say, third and fifth largest source of traffic. We send millions and millions of visits every month to a number of sites. I think one site, which I won't name, I think we send about 15 million visits each month. I think that's somewhere between 15 and 20 million is where we top out. And yeah, we'll continue to do that indefinitely. I don't see that ever changing. I don't see us trying to do what Facebook and Google have done and launch a native format where we try to get everybody to, you know, to do like a Google AMP or a Facebook Instant Articles, anything like that. We're just, we're happy to send traffic. And like, honestly, I hope other publishers in the space view us as somebody who's good for the ecosystem and helping them. And I think media companies should maybe think about helping each other a little bit more in a world where the platforms are so powerful. So I think it's just a different way of thinking.
Have you thought ever about doing explicit partnerships with various sites in that arena or anything else like that?
Sorry, specific what?
Have you thought about having like partnerships with, I don't know, like the Big Lead or other sites like that in terms of like drawing it out as opposed to having it be, oh, a producer sees something and enters it in?
Thought about it. Yeah, we've thought about it. But at the end of the day, we would rather have, at least to date, just to kind of keep our operation as streamlined as possible. Because if we had editorial relationships with, you know, with even, you know, with you guys and the biggest publishers, it does create a lot of work on our end. And we're very glad that you guys appreciate getting the traffic. Maybe someday we will open up ways for more kind of maybe monetarily beneficial partnerships to emerge on our platform. But I think like right now it's pretty easy and works for both sides. And whereas, you know, maybe some other platforms have made it more difficult to get traffic off of them and have wanted more and more content to be native on their platforms. Again, we're just kind of happy to link back and make sure our users just know that we're a good entry point to find great content, whether it's from you guys or from other people.
You, in the last year or two, you guys have launched BR Mag, which is a platform within Bleacher Report for long form journalism. Can you tell our listeners who may not be familiar with it, just kind of the elevator pitch for BR Mag and if there's been any stories on there that you're especially proud to have published?
So we care deeply about storytelling. I think that storytelling, when done effectively, makes sports fans feel more invested in the people that we tell the stories about. And it makes what you see on the field or on the court matter more to you. And that's like, to me, that's when sports are at their finest, when they become emotional and when they become more personal for you. And so as we've grown as a business and had more money to invest in content, we have pushed a larger investment towards storytelling and hiring great feature writers. Oftentimes, having those stories be more kind of multimedia in nature. Jonathan Abrams did a great piece with Vince Carter on the art of the dunk that was part video, part visual graphics, part long form piece that came out in the last couple of months. We've Miran Fader, who's another one of our feature writers, just did an awesome piece where she was with the Ball family or followed the Ball family around in Lithuania. for I think almost 3 months, and the piece is called The LaMelo Show, and was maybe our most successful long form feature of the year. Did incredibly well on social platforms. I think even Instagram, which is, you know, notoriously hard to kind of get traffic out of, just by putting the piece in our bio, we got over 100,000 people to go from Instagram back to Bleacher Report, which is really cool. I mean, there's just a lot of really compelling stories that we're able to tell, and some of them might turn into, you know, larger video pieces at some point, or inspire other things that we'll do. But I just think in a world where it is harder and harder to finance journalism and to make a business out of it, those of us who are in position to do it and to tell great stories that will inspire, especially, you know, our generation of users, which is a huge percentage of our users, upwards of 80% are under 35. If you factor in social and all the engagement we have there. So I just think it's important to tell great stories to that generation. But BR Mag is doing really well, and we're excited about all the recognition it's received awards wise, which is amazing and humbling. And we plan to continue pushing it forward and continuing to invest in multimedia approaches and all kinds of good stuff.
A couple years ago, you took a sabbatical where you stepped away from the day-to-day operations, Bleacher Report, and you traveled, you did some consulting. What was some of the best places you traveled? And was there anything about being away for a little bit of time that caused you to see things a little bit clearer?
So I had always, as I was working on Bleacher Report from 2005 to the end of 2014, which is when I stepped away, my kind of like pot of gold at the end of the rainbow was always going and traveling. And my wife and I got married in 2013. And at the end of 2014, my wife and I took off for 8 months. We started in Japan, and then we went skiing in Japan for a couple of weeks, which is amazing. If you're into skiing, Japan has some of the best powder skiing in the world. And then we spent time in New Zealand and Australia. We went to the Cricket World Cup, which was pretty cool. It was a lot more fun and less boring than I thought it was going to be. I kind of like cricket kind of clicked for me. It was all right. We spent time in India and Bhutan. It was incredible. It was just incredible how many Indian people. I mean, you expect to see a lot of cricket actually in India, but how many younger Indian people wore soccer jerseys, especially Manchester United jerseys, which is incredibly popular in India. And just in general, like, the dominance of soccer culture all over the world is so pronounced, and seeing it up close and in person is a pretty incredible thing. We spent time in Southern Africa later, and we're in Windhoek, Namibia, which is the biggest city in Namibia, in Southwest Africa. And there are four large tribes in Namibia, and amongst other things, they had split up Premier League clubs along tribal lines. So like one tribe, at least this is what we were told, that one tribe is a big Man U supporter, another's Chelsea, another's Liverpool, and the other's Arsenal. And it's just like that, just seeing that up close in person. We spent a bunch of time in Europe too, and got to go to the Champions League in Berlin that year between Barca and Juve. And it was just like, from a sports standpoint, just really, really cool to get more immersed in soccer culture. But it's always healthy to take a step back, especially when you've been doing something as long as I had. And definitely just re-energized me and helped kind of clarify some focus things for me around what Bleacher Report needed to, or at least what I thought it needed to do next. So I know it's hard for a lot of people to be able to do this, and I've been really fortunate, but I'm very, very supportive even of our employees at BR, if they can, you know, to go take a sabbatical or go take some time off and travel and just kind of free their minds from the day-to-day burden. Cause sometimes you just need that, and it's healthy.
you mentioned seeing all like the soccer culture all over the world, and I know Bleacher Report is ramping up its soccer coverage in advance of the World Cup, and then Turner's acquisition of the Champions League. And you guys have a foothold in the UK. I'm wondering, as you see the next 24, 36 months, is international expansion of Bleacher Report at the top of your ambition list?
I don't know if it's at the top of our ambition list. Has happened organically over time, both through social, through our app, and honestly, through not just our soccer coverage, but as basketball has become more and more popular internationally, our traffic just grows overseas and in the markets that you would expect it to. And I think, I would say our number one priority is really just continuing to strengthen engagement in the United States and giving fans more and more reasons to feel super connected to our brand, which, I think we're doing an okay job of and we're making progress towards, but we have a long way to go in terms of where we want to be. But, and our engagement rates are, I don't mean to say that flippantly. We have the best engagement rates of any sports media brand across social platforms. And we're doing great in a lot of ways, but we always want to do better. Internationally, there's a lot of growth out there for us over time, I think. And what we're doing around soccer now in particular, and I think some of the things we'll do around basketball in the future will probably be the two main catalysts for continued international growth.
Okay, and then real quick question. A month or two ago, you were in headlines. You were talking about Barstool Sports on a different podcast, and you were at the beginning mostly complimentary of them, and you said you were rooting for them. But at the end, you described it as a kind of fraternity content and country club content. Do you wish now, looking back at it, that you had used words with different connotations in describing Barstool, or do you stand by what you said in that interview?
I would say that was just a funny series of events for me. I actually, I thought I was complimentary and fair and balanced in that interview, and didn't really think twice about my comments. And then I was, had gone on a long business trip to the East Coast, and was staying the weekend in with a friend in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I got that super bad flu that had been going around the East Coast, and was I quarantined myself in my friend's house and was binge watching the Netflix show Dark, just like sick as hell, and then I started to see that pop up on my phone. And it was just like one of those things where I was kind of like, I can't deal with this right now. So I deleted Twitter for, a week and a half or something, and had friends making fun of me and texting me about the stuff that was going on. It was all, I've kind of made a decision that I would rather be more open and try to be fair and balanced and talk about the industry that we're in. And if stuff like that happens every once in a while, I've had Mark Cuban go off on me on Twitter, and that's an interesting thing to happen too. It's like it happens. What's that?
I said we're both members of the Mark Cuban having gone after each other on Twitter.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's a bit of a cost of doing business, and it's impressive how loyal, or just like how engaged Barstool's hardcore fan base is. And I kind of stand by my comments, wish them the best. I'm impressed by a bunch of different stuff that they do, and it kind of is what it is.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about, either about Bleacher Report or your personal journey, that you want to discuss right now on this platform?
I think I'm good, unless you want to ask me anything else.
But no, I think we're good.
Good amount of stuff.
Appreciate your time once again. This is Dave Finocchio, CEO and co-founder of Bleacher Report. This is the Glass Half Empty podcast. Thanks to everybody who made it this far, and we'll see you again soon.
Such turned strange.